part two is as follows. Daycare center, two-story, 120 by 120, class one. Approximately 5-0 children after school hours, senior citizens on the second floor.
Falcon Engine 11.
Engine 11.
We're still out here, a full still. We just had an explosion. We had an apartment that exploded. Traffic to Channel 2 at 103-0, advise.
103 zero, we're directing your location, Southend.
And Lilac.
Southend, we have working fire out here.
Six Piper and Lilac for engine 7, engine 4, engine 2, engine 1, 27, Quint 1, rescue 1, fire 1.
Welcome everybody to this edition of Buildings on Fire Station Street.
Yeah, Battalion 1 to Main Emergency, give me a bag. I'm going to set the station area, Chicago and Lakeshore Drive. I'll give you the stairwells in a minute, Austin. We have a fire up there. Main to 271. 271. We have report of three people on the roof in need of rescue.
Three people on the roof in need of rescue. Message received.
For the fire service through provocative insights and dynamic discussion dedicated to the art and science of firefighting and the traditions of the fire service. And again, it's continuous, straightforward, street-level talk, intelligent, stimulating, provocative conversations, just like around the kitchen table or the day room over a cup of coffee at 2 o'clock in the morning after a good run, and we certainly all know much about that. So again, welcome to our listeners here tonight on Buildings on Fire, Taking It to the Streets. We've got a little bit of a different format here tonight as we approach the end of the year here in 2021. For those of you that have been following us on a regular basis, you know and have always been accustomed to a pretty straightforward, in-depth discussion with a variety of different guests that we have on our program, talking about a particular topical issue about the built environment, certain construction occupancies, incidences, and so forth. We had a great four-run series this year on brick and joist construction, talking about Type 3 construction. We did some mega mansions earlier this year, and again, a mixture of a variety of different programs. The one thing we've been pretty consistent on over the last number of years has been our multiple series programs. We've always felt that it's been too shallow and very limiting to really try to talk about a topic that doesn't do the topic justice when you are just doing something for a short 30-minute time frame or something up to an hour standpoint. You know, we've typically run well into the 90-minute to 120-minute and then a little bit then some on our programs. But that is the level of intensity that this particular topical area, the functional area of the job, is all about when we talk about built environment, construction, and so forth. So we changed it up a little bit just based upon what all of us, and I'm going to introduce our guests here in a moment, all of us have recognized through our online engagement, through our conversations offline, and through our conversations and monitoring both in the classroom and some of the things that are going on the social media footprint, again, on both a national and international standpoint. So we chose to create this open forum, or really a caller conversation, focusing in on the broad area of the built environment, construction, tactics, and operations, all revolving around risk management and safety. I mean, that's first and foremost. And really trying to incite and entice, I guess, both ways around it, over the last number of days when we started publicizing and promoting the program, is really for a caller-driven conversation where the caller drives the agenda, drives the questions, the comments, and the perspectives that all of us can delve into. And hopefully we will get that. So for those of you that are listening live, our guest call-in number is area code 760-454-8852. 760-454-8852, and we will be announcing that regularly as we go through there. If you're listening in, again, you can actually log in and go to fireengineering.com, Blog Talk Radio, and you can actually find our episode and the information right there. Our short link is up. It's http semicolon backslash double backslash tobtr.com/s/12039731. So we'll get through that with formality. So again, I'm your host, Chris Naum. I'm in New York. Joining us on this episode is Doug Klein out of South Carolina, Mike Lapina out of the Chicagoland, Illinois area, Mike Richardson out of Kentucky, and Rick DeGroot out of Pennsylvania. So my brothers, welcome guys. It's certainly a pleasure to have you guys on our program here tonight.
Thank you, Chris.
Thanks, Chris.
Give me an acknowledgement. Doug, are you there?
Yeah, I'm here. I said, thanks, Chris. Just to our listeners, too.
Mike, are you there?
Dialing in on that number.
Yeah, I'm here,
yeah,
Chris.
We're all here, yes, Chris.
Yeah, I think both mics answered you.
Guys, can you hear me?
Yes.
You know what you call that, don't you? That's called technical difficulty. Let me hit him up.
Presuming I've got my guys on here, and
yep.
I'm not hearing anything differently. So,
yeah, I just shot him a text. So just for our listeners, too, to know, once you get in and call in and
okay,
get into the host queue, you press 1. So just remember that as a call-in person.
How's that sound, guys? Anything better?
We can hear you fine, Chris.
Stand by
I guess you're not hearing up.
Stand by. I'm gonna call back in again, so hold on.
Okay. Take it away, Doug.
Yeah. Well, you know, we talk about this built environment, and we talk about tactics, and we've talked about a lot of things over the last year, and all of us have gotten together you know, through some of these shows. There's been a variety of, you know, who was on and who was not. But, you know, one of the things that I'm seeing is that our folks that are in the streets with some of the changes that are going on, I don't know how close they're paying attention to the engineering facets that are going into building buildings today, the types of materials, the engineering designs, and the features, and what that impact is going to have on us when we're responding to those calls, especially in what we will call the engineered lightweight, quote-unquote, type of construction. And, again, I used engineering for that. So just throwing it out there to you guys, what are y'all seeing that's happening in your areas? Because we're diverse. I mean, we're kind of spread out a little bit. We're in different geographic regions of the United States and a variety of different response districts. So what are y'all seeing?
Well, if I might, Doug, I think at least in the Chicago area and, you know, throughout the Midwest where we have obviously a very, certainly not like the East Coast, an older building stock going back now about 200 years in this region. And certainly a lot more lightweight going up, and especially in our collar suburbs. I'd say, at least in this area, we're hyper-vigilant on the lightweight stuff. You know, I mean, we're really, really aware with that. Where I see us getting into problems when we do have fire ground issues is we're forgetting some of the things we need to look at with older style constructions where, you know, one of the things I asked Chris to bring up, or I wanted to bring up tonight, was talking about half stories, finished attic spaces, livable attic spaces. And that continues to plague us where, you know, we overlook that. Sure, we know about lightweight. We know about all the hazards of early collapse and the lighter weight material, the less, you know, no mass. But we take for granted, I think, the older style of construction and we assume too much. And, you know, based on fire loading today, our tactics are still based on 1950s. In some cases, our tactics are still based on 1950s technology and information that we had. So we presume that we have a longer time to operate in these structures, whereas with the fire loading we have and the quicker reaching our temperatures and stuff, that we're getting ourselves into trouble. So yeah, I mean, certainly lightweight is a problem, and there's some unique things out there that, that challenge us. But I think, at least like I said, in our area, we are aware of that, and we take that into account, and we like I said, for lack of better words, we're very hypervigilant on that. So I don't know if you, Mike Richardson or Rick, you've seen that on Pennsylvania, or Mike, you've seen that down in Kentucky, but that's my take on it, at least in our area.
Hey, guys, can you hear me now? I'm back on.
Yes.
Okay, excellent. You can hear me, Chris. I just called. Yep, excellent. So I wanted Mike to continue on with his conversation, which was really, really great. So let me just, again, another quick blurb about the guest call-in, 760-454-8852, for those of you that are listening and have an interest in calling in. So, you know, Mike, you just started talking about some of the local issues, and all of us, I mean, although we are predominantly – all of us are coming from the East Coast areas, and Mike's coming from the Midwest. And unfortunately, we didn't have any opportunity to bring in some of our frequent contributors from the West Coast. But it is important to note that there's a lot going on in our geographical areas, and I think we've all seen that both in terms of the challenges online in particular, the kinds of questions that are being posed, the kinds of information that people have no insights on, and Rick, you know, especially with the stuff that's going online with, you know, a posting of a photograph from one part of the country, and then suddenly the chirping in of many of the participants that are on the Facebook page for building construction for the fire service. What I've noticed, and Mike Richardson, I think you've noticed also, is that it's surprising how limiting the insights may be in terms of the knowledge that's out there. We are pretty good in knowing what we know in the very local kind of circle that we operate within, whether it be our first two, whether it's our local box and so forth, or some geographical boundary that's sort of out there. But once we get past it, we don't have that level of insight. So, Mike Richardson, actually, Rick, I'll have you comment on it. So, you know, we'll start that conversation. So, well, what's your take on that? I mean, is it an educational issue that's a huge gap that's out there? Is it the fact that we're just not training enough? We're not making people aware of it? Is it apathy? Is it complacency? You know, what's your take on that?
Chris, I think it's a combination of a number of those factors. One of the things that continues to bother me, and I do a lot of recruit training at my current job, and under the current Pennsylvania NFPA standards for a Firefighter 1 training, they only get around 4 hours of building instruction. So they've barely cracked the surface on that. And the other thing I get is my experience with the Facebook page. I can throw up a post about, I did one the other day. One of my friends from Howard County sent me some local pictures of a lightweight constructed townhouse complex. And I got more feedback on that, you know, all kinds of, I don't want to call it hysterical, but, you know, like, the sky is falling because they're building lightweight stuff. I don't think these guys understand they've been building lightweight stuff for 40 years.
Yeah.
And then I can throw up, something up about, an older type of construction. I did a question of the week a couple weeks ago on reinforcing stars on older Type 3 buildings.
Yeah.
And didn't get a lot of play on that.
You know, it
struck me.
Well, you know, Mike Richardson, you know, you're pretty vocal about some of this stuff too. So, you know, I truly believe there is this complete lack of literacy, this lack of knowledge in many pockets of the United States, or even in North America if we include the provinces of Canada. But it fundamentally goes back to what we may have learned or been exposed to day one. Or as we've promoted up into our various positions, we only know what we know, and we don't know what we don't know. And therefore, if there is no continuous immersion of the topic, if we're fighting fires the way we've been fighting, as Michael Pina has been talking about from back in the 50s and 60s, we will continue to go down these continuous paths with rhetorical rhetoric of how bad things are, what we don't know, and all of this, let's scare everybody to death about construction when, in fact, there is such a lack of accurate technical information and that's just this anecdotal stuff that just keeps passing down generation from generation. Mike, what's your Mike Richardson? What's your take on that?
Thanks, Chris. I'll kind of go at this from a different angle. I'll apologize, but some of the other stuff I'm involved in, there was a ton of research that's come out of the European Fire Service on decision making. And the issue they're finding is that we're not great at making decisions. We either don't make decisions, if you will. We hit autopilot, so we're not even thinking about building construction. We're just going to grab a pre-connected entrance recorder and run in the front door and spray water on the fire. So that's issue one, is that we have not trained the decision makers how to make the decisions or the need to make those decisions. So we get a lot of just, if you will, muscle memory, instinctual reactions. So that decision-making process doesn't exist. Or to your point, they're lacking, if we're going to use, for example, recognition prime decision-making, they don't have that database or slide tray or whatever you want to call it to draw from. So when they try to make that decision, they're limited into what information they can pull from. So I think it's, and the other thing is I see a ton of focus in the fire service right now on psychomotor cognitive skills, but I don't see the focus on cognitive, you know, decision-making once again. So I think there's a ton of time and focus going into, you know, the basics, which we need. But when you make that step up from that basic firefighter to that decision maker, company officer, or incident commander, that piece that takes you to that next level is missing.
And those are great insights. You know, you talk about, for our listeners, and when we talk about recognition prime decision making, and again, this has been something that's been out there since the mid-1980s as a discussion point, as it was introduced into the fire service. It has transitioned and evolved into what we now call naturalistic decision making. But, Mike, you hit the point right straight on. When we talk about recognition prime or naturalistic decision making, you have to have some referencing points to go back to. So if we constantly are in this, you know, just stretching the line and going in without having any type of considerations, critical thinking, just managing the tactical windows, managing the environment, managing the elements of that building, that occupancy, construction, and so forth, then we are just setting ourselves up for some potential adverse conditions that certainly all of us have been very much aware of. Doug, you know, you've been involved with some things on the research side, coupled with this, the continuing dialogue as an advocate, certainly in all of our forums on construction and operations over the last, certainly over the last 10 years as part of our team. Now, being involved in the training side also from your standpoint, where are you seeing the gaps? I mean, we're seeing some very knowledgeable, enthusiastic firefighters, recruits that are coming through. We're seeing officers that are being promoted up. What's your take on the issues of construction and bridging that gap between what we're being being introduced to and hopefully starting to formalize more with the research and the information coming out of R&D and suggested modeling and practices and such? How are you seeing that going down the path, especially in the southeastern region?
Well, I'm going to jump back and just reiterate what he was saying. We don't spend a lot of time on training our people, and I'm going to use two different concepts here. I'm going to actually use the professional development model that I use with four concepts that go with that. We don't give them a lot of skills to go with their knowledge, and we don't give a lot of knowledge to go with their skills. That's our first problem. When we're talking about giving a firefighter something that is about 4 to 6 hours on building construction, which is their battleground that they're going into, I think we're doing a tremendous disjustice to our firefighters, because they're not able to synthesize to the degree that we should. But the other problem continues on in this, and I see this in the research that I've done with education and things like that. We're also seeing it as we tie it to research with the strategy and tactics of fire suppression how long buildings actually withstand degradation by fire. Some of that stuff started with the Phoenix Fire Department, and those studies it's continued to NIST and UL. But you think about it, you go to Fire Officer 1, how much building construction is in the NFPA standard 1021 all the way through all levels? It's not there. There's nothing more once you get out of 1001 that really talks about that. And that's part of the problem. And even when we start looking at making individuals officers and promoting them up, they're not getting a lot of additional education or formats that go with that for their knowledge. And the only way they're getting a lot more or substantial true knowledge to go to match up to skills, which helps with their experience, you know, that's there is if they go through a fire science program and they actually go through a semester of building construction, which gets a lot more in depth, or if they have to take that second building construction. And if
let me stop that for a second. You know, we constantly push everybody to the direction they ought to be going. And so let's really just cut to the chase. Why is it that the majority of the American Fire Service, here we are at least 10, 12, about 14 years into this kind of conversation that started about 10 or 12 years ago, why is it that academies and recruit schools and promotional schools and so forth have not recognized that need and implemented the changes? So we'll be talking about this into the years ahead, saying, all right, you know, the 1001 series, the 1021, nothing's changed dramatically. We've added a couple of minor, you know, minutes here and there, but at the end of the day, guys, and I think we're all of the opinion, when is somebody going to step up and really push the agenda to get this kind of education and technical skill set level implemented? I mean, I think that we all can agree that there's a lot of opportunities. All of us have been involved in these opportunities by presenting programs throughout the United States, online, in person, and so forth. Sometimes we're filling the room, and sometimes it's the crickets are out there, and we've got just a handful of people, right?
Well, that's true, and I think one of the biggest things is that this type of topic is not sexy, and it's not getting the rah-rah that, you know, if we're talking about, you know, running into burning buildings and doing all these things. It's an analytical piece that most people don't have, and, you know, I've had conversations with metro departments. I've had conversations with large county departments. Very few of them have a lot of developmental programs that are in place that says what officers should have. And, you know, one of the things, and I have been crucified over this multiple times for saying, you know, of setting certain expectations of knowledge and skills and experience and self-development that should have occurred before we put people into positions. And, I mean, I've taken a beating on a couple of these, and one of them is, you know, the programs that, you know, like in the professional development model that I show folks, and I'm doing that at FDIC again, talking about developing the next generation of fire service leaders. I talk about building construction classes from every type of class that you can get, and it exists. Our fire academies have a lot of these programs, but people just don't take them because it's not the sexy stuff. The National Fire Academy has an online program that you can take that's a good program. And, you know, why are we not pushing this stuff? You know, part of it is a lot of times it's the being ignored, I think, Chris, that has gone on forever and ever. I mean, many people have vocalized this. I just don't think that it's getting the right attention. But if we start going back to the root cause and the root problems of decision-making of officers and how they got into those positions, it's the lack of understanding of the building, how it's going to perform, and how the fire is actually going to perform in that box and what's going to happen next in those components, you know, and compartments that are in there. And we've talked about this significantly. I just don't think that people are listening, to be honest.
Let me ask
it's in every NIOSH report, Doug. Sorry.
Absolutely. It's there.
It says right in there. Lack of recognition of building construction, lack of recognition of fire behavior, lack of proper fire ground communication. It is a It is a broken record when you read a NIOSH line of duty death, traumatic fireground line of duty death, that it is one, those top three things, or a combination or all three of them together, and almost always lack of recognition of building construction is a constant on those traumatic line of duty death, fire ground line of duty deaths. And certainly that's not to say, oh, you know, those men and women that died, you know, shame on them. No, that's not it. We need to stop repeating the cycle. We've identified the problem. We identified that there is a lack of recognition. So please, people, start to recognize, take the time to size up the building properly, and take the time to see what's going on. If I wanted to jump in real quick, because to Rick's point about Pennsylvania and the NFPA requirements, preaching to the choir, Rick, we got the same problem in Illinois. It was identified in a NIOSH report from 2010 that an incident commander of a fire in suburban Chicago had over 900 hours of formal documented Illinois Office of State Fire Marshal certification between what we called then Firefighter 2, Firefighter 3, Fire Officer 1, and Fire Officer 2, over 900 hours of formal training in the state of Illinois required to get those four certifications. Only 6 to 8 hours is required to be spent on building construction and fire behavior. So to that point, less than 1% of what we need to know 100% of on the fire ground is spent learning in the classroom when we're going through all this formal education. And Doug, to your point about the fire officer certification, there is no NFPA requirement on building construction and fire behavior in that. It all comes from your basic fire academy and a little bit in the advanced firefighter, or I think nationally what's known as Fire 2. In Illinois, we call it advanced firefighter. To Mike Richardson's point, I believe he brought up, we continue to just, go in the front. All it is going through the front door and spraying water. We have new good information, solid information, solid firefighting, aggressive firefighting that says, hey, maybe going through the front door isn't the best option in this situation. It doesn't take away your aggressive tactics or anything. In fact, going around maybe to a side door or a basement window and attacking the fire is the more aggressive and actually does better to keep fire spread from the upper floors of say a two-story house or something. All this information is out there and people just aren't paying attention to it. But when your fire academies and everything and your certifications are geared to minimum standards, whether it's a budget thing or it's just we don't have time to spend on this, that's all we're going to teach is minimum standard, and we leave it up to every individual in the fire service to take it upon themselves to better themselves and to get that information. And I think that's where we're losing a lot of the stuff that Doug's talking about, where people, where are we failing? Well, it's because we teach the absolute minimum standard because that's what's required. But there is no above and beyond, whether it's a money or a time constraint. And then after that, it's like, oh, cool, I got my fire too, or I got my advanced fire, whatever. I'm good. See you in 20 years when I retire or whatever. There's just no emphasis. It's left up to the individual to go and get that additional knowledge.
I think, too, there's another thing when you attribute it back to NIOSH recommendations and findings. One of the other aspects is the trade-off of what is given in various either in-service, initial in-service, or promotional training environments is that the expectations for many departments, especially within the career and metro side, is that the education ends up defaulting back to the house. It defaults back to the captain. It defaults back to the company through various other resources that are coming out of the training division to take bulletins and information and create the drills and so forth. And that in itself is precarious because the quality and the consistency becomes faulted or diluted based upon the delivery of that content, as well as the accuracy. I mean, I've seen some horrendous presentations of a highly technical topic such as this with the degree of inaccuracies and anecdotal information, and I can tell exactly which particular book someone took their comments out of, and then the opinions come into play based upon, you know, the topic that they're delving into. I'm going to ask everybody a question here, since we're focusing in on the training side just for a moment. So one of the things that I believe requires some attention, so the Fesci model that has been consistently out there for curriculum-based education, training, and skill sets that takes the various types of technical books, and there are a number of them that are utilized on promotional exams or some of which are still current in most people's perspectives. So we have the textbooks that are out there. Then we have the Fesci model that follows the leading textbooks, of which we have Chapter 1, Chapter 20, and here's the content, and we don't delve anything beyond the limited information that's in each one of those chapters based upon occupancy, based upon the five building construction types, and have a nice day. That's pretty much it. Do you think that there is a need to change the modeling of our curriculums to, number one, be more robust and in-depth, and really change up the manner in which we train, the initial and continuing training, promotional training? So the question is, do you believe that the Fesci model is at fault or has a series of challenges because of its being somewhat outdated and not keeping up with what we are now learning, certainly over the last, let's say, 5 to 10 year period? Mike Lapino, I'll get back to you. So we'll go Mike Richardson, Rick, Doug, and then Mike Lapina. So, Mike Richardson, what's your take on that? I know you're a pretty passionate guy on the training side, and again, just talking about this whole issue with cognitive skill set, technical basis, and the stuff that's out there. We've been around long enough to see where this has all come from and where it's going. What's your opinion on it?
Chris, I'll kind of get back to some of my earlier comments. I think there's knowledge for the sake of knowledge, and there's knowledge that you can actually take out and apply. When we talk about knowledge that comes from education, then we talk about our ability, which builds into experience. Whatever it is we're learning, whether it's in college, it's in the firehouse, it's whatever, it has to get to a point where I can take a piece of information, take that out on the street, and that's going to allow me to make safe and effective decisions. And I think we have a disconnect there where at times, like you said, we've taught people these are the five types of building construction. Okay, you can show me pictures all day and I can tell you that's a type one, that's a type three. But when I show up at the building, it's on fire at 3 o'clock in the morning, that has no play in my decision-making process. And I think, once again, there's a disconnect there where we have to be able to build knowledge in the education phase, but that has to then translate through the skill and the application phases that where we're taking that and actually being able to go out and use that. And I think that piece is missing from most of the current programs. So that would be my take on it.
Yeah, that's great, great insights. Rick, what do you think from your perspective?
I go back to one of the other gentlemen mentioned that it's just not a glamorous topic. I will see, I struggle to get, 4, 5, 6 people to come to a building construction class at my fire academy here in Chester County, PA. But we'll bring in somebody that shows some new forceful entry technique on the simulator, and there's students out the door. I mean, it's just – It doesn't compute with me that folks haven't embraced the fact that it's the building that's going to kill them. And way before we're trying to force entry into that building, we should be looking at the building and seeing what's going on in terms of its structural stability. We hyper-focus, I think, on those kind of things and not on the big picture. The other comment I wanted to make was Vincent Dunn had a great comment. There was some conversation going back and forth on my group page a while back. And Vincent Dunn jumped in out of the blue, which amazes me. And he just simply said, there's nothing new in the equation of building construction other than the new firefighter. And I think we need to understand that.
It's interesting. And again, I recall reading that threads, and he's been very, very much vocal on a number of different platforms pertaining to that. Surprisingly enough, it's interesting on a national level how few individuals of the current generation know who Chief Dunn was or is. And it's also the standpoint when you talk about Frank Brannigan. Recently, again, just fortunately getting back out into the national circuit here, when I pose a series of questions, one of which, again, do you know who Frank Brannigan was? The responses are, you know, glaring in the eyes. They've never heard of him. They've never heard of any number of a series, whether it be Chief Dunn's books or Brannigan's books or any other series of books that are out there on reading lists or just that are available. So, again, it's this continuing vacuum that continues to be sucked out of everything, even though we are talking about all of these different things today about NIST and you know, reading the fire and fire dynamics and so on and so forth. They all are meaningless, even when we talk about the tactical approaches of aggressive firefighting. They are all meaningless unless we understand the building. So, Doug, what's your take on this? I mean, you and I have gone down this path for quite a number of years, nationally and online and in face-to-face things. And I know you've had we've had our sidebar conversations about what's going on here in these classrooms. You know, when we've taken our breaks and so forth. So, what's your take on how to fix this, or what needs to be fixed?
Well, I think it all comes down to the leadership of the fire service. And, you know, mentioning that people don't know who Vinnie Dunn is or people don't know who Frank Brannigan is, you know, that is part of what I talked about not long ago when I was in West Virginia at an instructor conference about preserving our history and flavoring our future and being the salt that preserves and the salt that flavors. Part of what we're seeing is, and you know, I love the analogy about, you know, somebody's doing forcible entry and they got a prop and everybody lines up and nobody shows up, you know, for the building construction class. And I think it all comes back to the perspectives of what leaders are doing, specifically the company officers. The models that are out there, the FESCI models, the books have changed, and the books today that are there have been updated. They have some of this modern stuff in it, you know, that's so critical when it comes down to research, when it comes down to data. We're probably better today about putting in some of that stuff than what we have in the past because it just didn't exist. We've got a lot today. I think the biggest thing comes down to is that we've lost our focus. And somehow, some way, somewhere, we've got to get this focus back, and we've got to get, you know, company officers specifically being the true trainers of the fire service, you know, excited to talk about what's important. I mean, if you go to a military establishment, had the opportunity to be in Beaufort, North Carolina, or South Carolina, actually, this past weekend on Parris Island doing a Firefighter 1 evaluation, and I can promise you those Marines that went running by that day understood what they were doing. They understood the area that I was beside of that was marked off for tactical operations. They study their environment. They study their battlefield and become very attuned and intimate with the knowledge of where they're going to be at. And they become intimately knowledgeable about their enemy. For us, buildings and fire. We're just not getting people talking about this at the right levels. This should be on the minds of every fire chief and every chief officer why their officers are not doing this. And we've had these conversations, you know, in conferences. We've had these conversations in classrooms. We've had these conversations online. And we've had these conversations in our organizations. The problem is they just blow it off. And again, I come back to it's they think they know, but they don't know. And that's what's the really scary part, is that what they think they know, they really don't know that much about. And when we start looking at this, this is where we got to jump in and start raising the bar. And I don't know exactly what the catalyst is going to be to raise the bar, but history repeats itself. I mean, when we talk about NOS reports and everything that's in there, we talk about line of duty death reports. We talk about near miss reports. It's all there. I don't care whether it's a department level. I don't care if it's in, you know, South Carolina. I don't care if it's in Texas or Illinois or Wisconsin or the Dakotas or Oregon. It's all the same. It's not any different. And until we recognize that and get off of our high horses, I think, in our thought process that everything's about the sexy stuff of the fire service, but going back and utilizing, you know, our basics and taking the technology that exists and enhancing what the basics tell us about it. I mean, we've got a lot of technology today that will tell us and give us the ability to predict even more so than we've ever had before. I think we've just got to get a cultural change in the fire service to realize the importance. It was important when I came through. It's like Dave Dotson in 1993 that distracted me at FDIC, standing in a room in Cincinnati about the art of reading smoke or listening to Frank Brannigan talk about building construction or all these things that were important then are just as important today. And I think we've lost that. And a lot of it is, again, I think the social media drives this. Anybody can be an expert today. Just ask them. They post on social media, and there you go.
It's interesting, Doug. You know, you just hit upon a couple of items here that I'll make a couple of comments on, and then I'll ask for Mike Lapina's closing comments on this particular thread. But I think that there is a challenge out there, and I'm going to use those words in a politically correct manner here, that there is a significant, sizable number of instructors who are not technically competent in the topical area. Therefore, we revert back to what they know in their limited scope, what they have read in their limited scope, and don't apply any of the other elements that Mike Richardson has been conveying and advocating here on our discussion thus far. So that they're not able to apply some of the other nuances that have come about within the built environment that have changed that built environment. It's no longer fundamentally just that five building types that falls into the cookie cutter approach of a particular curriculum outline that falls in line with a particular textbook's chapters that are limiting at best. I mean, you know, it goes into the standpoint that one has to have a significant volume of technical books and manuals from both the fire service as well as the external engineering and architectural and ancillary areas to develop, number one, a foundation of knowledge, and then to robustly be able to expand that, and then to utilize the critical thinking and all of the development of the cognitive skills and the technical basis and so forth to go forward. So that's the first item. And then the second part of that is that I think the majority of people that would potentially be an audience are afraid to take the classes because they are too technically based. It's no different than sitting in on a hazmat class. You know, it's a very niched particular area, but in this case, it's the fundamentals of everything that we do. So, you know, it's twofold along those particular lines, which gets me into the conversation with Mike. Mike, you and I have shared some conversations about curriculum and training and the reluctance of, at times, many national programs to, number one, embrace and promote building construction classes. So we've all been talking about, you know, you've got to go out and have this self-determination and have this initiative. If you can't get it at the department level, go out and seek it. But we've also recognized that it's very, very difficult at times to stay on an agenda or on a program when what we are selling is building construction, right? So what's your take on that?
So when we talk about
that, and again, it's a broken record. It's not sexy. It's not the force and entry. But I've had this conversation with a very well-respected instructor out of the Midwest that I used to teach forcible entry with. He still teaches forcible entry classes throughout the Midwest. But I tease him that, it's all well and good that you teach people how to force a door, but if they don't understand, they're not forcing a door just to go through a door prop. They're forcing a door to get into a building. So, great, you know how to pop that door. What's on the other side of that door? And before another guy that I know that teaches engine company ops, all well and good, you teach them to advance a line, but what are you advancing that line into? Through so-and-so's door prop? Cool. All of it ties into building construction and I don't have to try to prove it. It is fundamentally everything we do on the fire ground comes back to how that building is constructed and how it's going to fall apart under fire conditions. Nothing, forcible entry, line advancement, pull and ceiling, all that stuff is dependent on the type of structure you're in, not the occupancy. Not is it a daycare center? Is it a, that's one of the things that kills me is when people size things up, they size it up. I heard one the other day. We're on the scene of a multifamily apartment building. Multi-story, multifamily apartment building. Okay. Redundant. An apartment building is multifamily. And, but nothing about building construction. There's nothing in size-ups related to building construction. City of Chicago is still very good about that, and some of our suburbs still emphasize sizing up based on construction type and recognizing that. But we do need to do a better job with that. And to the point about it not being sexy, it doesn't have to be sexy, but not to get too much into the technical aspect of it. Sure, some of that, like I say when I teach, our building construction class is, it's important to know what a lintel is and a facade and the different types of terminology and the different components of the building. But at the end of the day, you have to understand the nuts and bolts of it, how a balloon frame is going to behave under fire conditions, how fire is going to travel through the type 3 or ordinary constructed building. That's what we have to focus on more than the technical aspects, which a lot of the community college classes focus on. Having taught building construction at the community college level, it was based off of Brannigan's book and some other books that featured more of the technical aspects of it versus tying it together, tying the tactics and the fire behavior into the type of construction.
And that's a great point because, again, it leads into, I think, what all of us have been conveying. It's an integrated approach. I think we all have through, especially with our programs here on our series, whenever we've gotten into a particular building type or an occupancy type and so forth, we've talked about occupancy risk versus the occupancy type. We've talked about the building type, and then we've talked about the predictability of its performance regarding, again, fire conditions, and then added into it the concepts and expanded upon the critical thinking component that Mike has talked about when we get into decision-making. I mean, it's part and parcel, and it's so, so critical to all of it. Let's take a quick break here. I'm going to do a quick little commercial, couple-of-minute break. We're going to come back. We're going to talk about some of the challenges moving forward with adaptive reuse, reutilization, and hybrid structures. So we're going to take just a couple-of-minute break. Again, you're listening to Buildings on Fire, Taking It to the Streets, open forum, caller conversation on the built environment, construction, tactics, and operations. So, again, for our guest call-in number, area code 760-454-8852, we do encourage any of you that are out there listening in, friends or otherwise, to call in and join in the conversation. So we're just going to take a couple-of-minute break, get a couple of new refreshments, some fresh coffee, and we'll be right back.
Looking for timely information and insights to support today's fire service demands? FireGroundLeadership.com provides outstanding e-media offerings across a broad range of topics that include lessons from the fireground, building construction and fire dynamics, adaptive fireground management, tactical discipline, and much more. FireGroundLeadership.com, operational excellence on today's evolving fireground. A buildingsonfire.com series, now on Penwell's Fire EMS blog, a part of the fireengineering.com, Firefighter Nation, Fire Rescue Magazine, e-media services.
So we're going to take a short break here, and I'm just going to actually just lead in on to a couple of items here while our guests grab a quick refreshment here. And for those of you that are listening live, I'm just going to talk about a couple of upcoming items here. So, again, as we move forward into 2022, hopefully coming out of our current challenges from the pandemic and so forth, many of you, again, will be looking forward to some face-to-face programming and opportunities. Certainly FDIC will be coming about in its normal time frame in April of 2022. And again, I encourage you guys to take a look at the online information, both for the pre-conference and conference-type settings. There's an exceptional series of offerings that will be available for next year, which will be consistent with the phenomenal opportunities both in the formal setting of the classrooms and workshop and the seminars basis, but more importantly, the conversations that occur around the tables and on the street sides and certainly within the hallways of the convention center and certainly throughout the Indy area. One of the things that we will be doing, as we did this past year in 2021, we'll be continuing our robust series of A View from the Street and Reading the Buildings, where we'll be providing some insights and offerings each day of FDIC week with some perspectives on the built environment, talking about particular building types, construction, and features throughout the area, and then tying that into some interactive activities for those that are at FDIC to identify some of these buildings and their travels and so forth and provide some insights. Many of us that will be there will be also doing some live radio programming right from the floor of FDIC within the convention center, and you can look forward to hearing us live there from FDIC in April talking about some topical items of importance and interest for the day. Certainly when we've talked about the items leading forward here on building construction, and again, for us being part of this and so immersed in it for the many years that we've been in the fire service, for many of us, the importance of it has become just second nature. It's not only part of the passion that we were introduced to, but we've recognized its importance in so many different ways, certainly at the tactical level, and then certainly as one assumes positions of responsibility, both at the company, at the command, and certainly at the incident command level of evolving incidences, both large and small. We made reference to the importance of reaching out, looking at lessons and learnings from the fireground, the importance that the NIOSH reports, as well as the near-miss reporting systems that are out there, the International Association of the Fire Chiefs, near-miss reporting database, again, continues to be a challenge in terms of getting input from near-miss event reporting, which is first and foremost and fundamental to be able to identify potential commonalities and common cause issues, near-miss events that may lead to potential adverse trends before something significant occurs. And those near-misses may lead to a significant injury, which may lead to a potential line-of-duty death or serious accident event that, again, requires some actions and corrective actions and so forth for improvements and such. So again, our guests on this episode include Doug Klein out of South Carolina, Mike Lapina out of Chicagoland, Illinois, Mike Richardson out of Kentucky, and Rick DeGroote out of our Pennsylvania area, and I'm out of New York here in upstate New York. So I wanted to talk a little bit about, and again, I'll just reiterate, call in listeners, please, area code 760-454-8852 if you're so inclined, and we're trying to communicate that on our social media footprint. And for those of you, please don't feel intimidated if you have a question, what better place and what better opportunity to ask that question with our great guest lineup here with their experience. So many of you are listening in and have a question that has been on your mind, please take advantage of this live format and such. So here's where I want to go with the next segment here in the next 30 minutes and so forth. One of the things that we've talked about in our discussions has been fundamentals of construction, the five fundamental building types, our occupancy risks, and issues dealing with decision-making, critical thinking, cognitive skill set levels, tying in that into an integrated standpoint of firefighting coupled with building construction, which ultimately leads back to human performance elements of the companies. One of the continuing challenges, and we actually did a program earlier this year as a part of a Zoom program independent of our podcasting here, where we had a conversation on hybrid construction. And there's two areas in which I think for all of us that are part of our ensemble here tonight, we've got quite a bit of insights on. Two areas that are certainly impacting the North American Fire Service is in the areas of hybrid construction and the aspects of the reutilization of our, especially of our older buildings. And I'll even frame that further to go into, say, our Type 3 and Type 4 constructed buildings, which continues to be a trend more so in the last 5 to 8 years. I think we saw some subtleties, if we go back historically, some things that started occurring back in the 90s, which lapsed, and then we started seeing this very subtle reoccurrence and then this very, very dramatic impact and changes in many jurisdictions and municipalities. I think when we talk about the urban areas of the United States and the provinces in Canada, there's certainly none that are not experiencing significant modifications to their older structures. And most of these in many areas are typical of the older construction, not just only Type 3 and Type 4, but some of the what we call our heritage construction from the turn of the late 1800s, early 1900s. And most of those are of Type 3 and Type 4, but they are also indicative of our earlier generations of what could be classified as both fireproof and non-fireproof type structures in a different classification era. And then the continuing issues with hybrid construction, which, as I think, Rick, you made mention when we talk about lightweight construction, or as I like to refer back to it, engineered structural systems. We think it was invented yesterday. We still have individuals that talk about it with nothing but doom and gloom. There's certainly a degree of respect that we have to have for that construction. But it's certainly not going away, and if anything, it is becoming more and more embedded into our hybrid structure. So I'm going to ask this question. So what is your take on either one, whether it be the hybrid construction trends or the reutilization or adaptive reuse of our older structures? And I'll just leave it as an open-ended item on that. Doug, I'll start with you. What's your perspective on some of the challenges? What are you seeing in not only in the Horry County area, but maybe on a more larger basis in the Carolinas, both North and South Carolina?
Well, I'm going to take the adaptive use. One of the things that is occurring is buildings that existed for years as something else. A good example is when I was the fire chief in the city of Eden. One of the big things was the revitalization and the utilization of structures that existed, which were the old mills. And many of these were renovated into very nice high-end type apartment, condo type buildings. Well, you know, that building is completely changed in the concept of what's there. It went from being a mill, you know, renovated into a residential, multifamily residential structure. Certainly the structure itself could handle the weight or the type of occupancy that was in there. But, you know, part of the things that have changed for the firefighting perspective is the types of loading or fuel loading that we put in there, the change of the sprinkler system from a regular sprinkler system to a 13-style R system. There were a lot of things that changed in those.
A big example of that also was in Carver, North Carolina, when they changed the Carver Mill into what they called the Car Mill Mall, which changed from a industrial style textile type building into now a multi commercial type building. So there were a lot of things that have changed with that. The biggest things is when you start making those changes to the building, there also comes with modifications to the building and potential, you know, the construction design features. One of the things that sticks out in my mind as a historical event was the renovations in the Vendome. And our line of duty deaths did not come during the middle of actual structural firefighting. It came when they were in overhaul phase and those type of things. So those are the things that stick out to me about those buildings that I don't think we spend enough time understanding that environment that's there and the complexities that go with that. We kind of take, oh, this is one of those heavy timber constructed buildings and nothing's going to happen now. Well, you know, it's a whole different ballgame because you redesigned the building. You took away some things out of the building. You know, what's changed? And the other part of that is they now start mixing and matching types of constructions. If they go in and renovate what used to be, you know, that type, you know, construction that was all heavy timber now becomes a wood frame type 5 construction inside, or an engineered system that's inside. It looks like something from the outside, but if you get down into the guts of the building, it's completely different. It's a normal, modern, constructed building that has an appearance. That's one of the big concerns to me.
Well, it's interesting, and again, I'm going to lead this conversation into Mike Richardson in a second here, but when we talk about reading the building, and it's, again, size up, so in our earlier segment, we talked about decision-making skill sets, size-up issues. If the fire service or company officers or commanding officers are having challenges just dealing with a conventional set of buildings that one encounters and responds to, and now we're talking about the adaptive reutilization and these hybrid structures, you know, I think we're seeing, again, the challenges that are imposed by the inability or the challenges themselves of how to read that building are, and it gets into a whole different skill set level of picking up upon some things that may either be obvious or one has to look deeper in beyond the distractions of what's on the outside of that building to try to key in on some elements that might indicate that, hey, I'm an adaptive reuse, I've been modified, I'm more than just the shell, the facade may show a type 3, but internally it's all, you know, been gutted out, it's all engineered construction, all opened up and so forth. So there's a lot of other takes on this that hopefully our listeners can gather some insights and recognize other buildings that are right in their particular first due, second due, mutual aid areas that are of that capacity. Key to all of this is going to be you've got to know your first due. You know, this stuff is not happening always under the cloak of darkness, although there's a lot of things that happen, you know, that are maybe not the code compliant things that happen at nighttime, but things that are dynamic and are happening every day in terms of construction, renovations, the coming soon signs, the dumpsters that are out front, you know, the construction activities and so on and so forth. So these things are happening, and it's up to the company and command officers to get their people out there, get themselves out there, and ask the questions and start looking at what's going on. So, Mike Richardson, certainly your particular region has seen and continues to see its fair share of all of these particular items. You've done quite a bit of work on the building reads and so forth, but we talk about things in both Lexington, things in Louisville and so forth, Whiskey Row, you know, the adaptive reuse of and the retainment of older buildings and how the front doesn't always match up with what's behind that curtain per se. So what's your take on either one of these particular items here as the challenges from a various perspective?
Yes, Chris, actually you took the words out of my mouth, and I would build on what you mentioned, which is we have to form very close partnerships with whoever it is that's handling the fire marshal code enforcement side of things. Because it is rare, it can happen, but in most cases, somebody's going to have to pull a permit, and that is a trail that should trigger someone to say, hey, what's going on in this building and what do we need to know about it? Because I'll be very frank and honest, some of my best company officers could not pull up and look at some of the buildings that are being built today or being modified or changed and recognize it from the street at 3 a.m. So if they don't have that pre-existing knowledge in some way, whether that comes through the fire marshal, the fire inspector, the building codes people, or if they don't get out and find it themselves, they're not going to be able to read that building from the street and know what's going on. So we've got to form that strategic partnership so that we're out with our codes people, our fire marshals. We're looking at this stuff. We're getting a heads up on it so that we can know that because it is becoming way, way, way more frequent. And we just can't show up at these buildings without prior knowledge and expect that we're going to be successful. A lot of people have alluded to it. You know, the buildings are our battlefield. I was in the Army. I'm never going to wander in to an unknown battlefield and plan on being successful. It's stupid to think that's going to happen. So we have to get that prior intelligence and knowledge so that, once again, we can kind of preload some things into that decision-making process, because if not, we're going to show up and it's basically going to be roll the dice and hope luck's on our side. And we know that that can be an issue because, you know, as Chief Brunicini said, you know, being lucky makes you dumb because you think you're a lot better than you are. So that's one of the things we got to definitely work on.
Yeah, that's certainly a very truism. And that's a great quote from Chief Brunicini. Rick, you know, certainly, and you, again, you've posted some great series when we talk about adaptive reuse and reutilization, and especially on our Type 3, Type 4. So, and again, from your background on a variety of different operational areas, what's your takeaway on this, or what are some of the words of wisdom that you would bring forward to, let's say, a current company or command officer regarding these buildings and some of the things that you've seen, you know, in that metropolitan area over the last number of years, which, again, when we take a look at what's happening, I don't want to say it's scary at best, but we understand that level of respect of what it is that we need to know. So what's your take on that perspective? Hey, Rick, can you guys hear me?
I can hear you, Chris.
Oh, okay. I didn't know if I ended up canceling out here. No, I guess maybe Rick is tied up here for a second. Mike, you're seeing a lot of stuff in the Chicagoland area, especially with the flats and
Chris,
the
walk-ups.
Oh, there you go, Rick. What's your take on the issues affecting, especially in your area, when we talk about Type 3s and 4s and reutilization, adaptive reuse of our older buildings? Well, what's some of the key takeaways that a company or command officer really needs to be knowledgeable of based upon what you have seen in these types of rehabilitations, renovations, and rehab and adaptive reuse of those buildings? What are the biggest takeaways, do you think?
Well, I think the two major takeaways is, number one, I'll reflect on what I believe Mike was saying before about the fire department being actively involved in the rehabilitation of these buildings well before they're occupied. You need to get the crews in there and take a look at what's going on. Some of them are, you know, they're like a lot of different things. Some of them are built to, you know, the minimum standard, and then there may be lightweight engineered components in there. And some of them are very well built and have, you know, very good systems in them. That'll certainly be, an aid to us if we have to deal with a fire in those buildings. I will say one thing is that if I had my druthers and I was going to personally move into a one of these loft-style buildings, I'll take the old style over the new lightweight engineered style any day. One of the testaments to these old buildings is that they're still around, many of them after 150 years. That says something about the structure of the building, at least to me. I also want to reflect, I think Mike talked about the military term recon. I'm not a military guy, but I love that term. And recon doesn't start at 3 a.m. when you're standing in front of the building. Recon starts months in advance, looking at your district, getting those of you that follow my group page know that my mantra is get out there and know your local. You got to know the lay of the land. I mean, it's crazy that we expect people to hang around, and then when the bell hits, they have to, have complete and intimate knowledge of a building. It's impossible. It's unrealistic to expect anybody to do so.
And that's key. You talk about building intel, the recon, tying that into what you're seeing at 2 o'clock in the morning or 2 o'clock in the afternoon. There is a tremendous degree of investment of time. I would say this to our listeners that, we've been talking about a variety of different topical items here. It all really starts and ends with what you know as an individual that are part of the team, part of the company, part of the alarm assignment, part of that box, part of what's in that street that has to go to work based upon the priorities and the issues and the demands and the challenges of that structure, that building, its occupancy, the risks that are present, and doing what's necessary based upon those priorities. And we understand what they very well may be. But it goes back to you going out into the streets. And I always state this out there, that the true testament of a good, well-rounded, proactive fire officer in particular is how many times you may have been threatened with being kicked off of a job site or have been threatened with arrest because you've been poking around these job sites and areas, after hours and so forth, and suddenly the cops show up and they're asking, what is it that you're doing? And you flash your badge and you're saying, I'm just trying to take pictures and I'm trying to get a sense of what's going on in this building. The best opportunities are on the weekends and during the downtime of construction, unless something is running 24/7. But, you've got to get engaged. You've got to take a look at your built environment. That simple residential structure that's down the road, or that more complex mid-rise, or that small commercial building, whether it be a small fast food restaurant that is of hybrid construction, or it's that mill building that's down the road that's being renovated, and there's a whole bunch of different things that are going in and out of that structure. Mike Lapina, you and I have had some conversation, and you actually posted some great insights on your group page, on the firefighter education group pages, talking about some of the things that are unique to the Chicagoland area with the various two and three flats, and especially the renovations and the subtleties of what, again, has been changed. That's pretty consistent when you read that building, or what you expect it to be on the front side versus going on any one of the other divisions or doing the 360 and seeing what's in the alleyway and so forth. So give a quick take on what you're seeing of not, these big, huge structures, but of the smaller size buildings, both commercial and residential, that are very common in your area that are also, in my opinion, very consistent with what others may be seeing in their areas across the United States.
Okay, sure, absolutely. So we see these changes being made, and one of the things, as we've all brought up here, it's important that the time to see these buildings is not at 3 in the morning when we're going there for a fire or whatever. It's when we're driving by, going shopping, or doing our in-service inspections, whatever we're doing, driving home from the firehouse, driving to the firehouse, whatever. Looking at these buildings, seeing what's going on, and noticing the changes are taking place to it when we're talking about adaptive use buildings. We look at we see these buildings, but there are clues that if maybe we didn't see that building, maybe we weren't around when that building was remodeled. But I go there at 3 in the morning, taking that 10 or 15 seconds, taking a breath, strapping my straps down on my SCBA before I get masked up to go in, whatever. This is what I try to convey to people. Look at the building. If you see sandstone up on top for coping on a building that you know is 100 years old, they didn't use sandstone for coping back 100 years ago. They used the clay pipe, the half pipes are for the coping. They didn't have glass block windows on buildings 100 years ago. You see
Even if you go to the same brick mill that made the brick of the building 100 years ago, you cannot completely duplicate exactly the color of the brick of the building 100 years ago. There's going to be differences. There's going to be things you notice that should tell you at least take pause before, to Mike Richardson's point, about just going through the front door to spray water. I start seeing some of these things that aren't natural to that building, knowing that that building was built, however many years ago. It is, true legacy Type 3 construction. Those things should tell you to slow down. If I go in through a front door, this is one of the things I try to preach to people. You go into a Type 3 building and you look up and you see a brand new, 2 foot by 3 foot or 2 foot by 4 foot sound absorbing ceiling tile up there or something. Those weren't around 100 years ago. There is something between that ceiling tile and the true natural ceiling of that building. There might be two or three ceilings between there and the true natural ceiling of that building. You cannot proceed. You cannot proceed until you get in there and look and see what you have above you. There are clues that even if it is 3 in the morning the first time you're going there, take the 10 or 15 seconds to look at those clues and say, aha, something is going on here.
Hello?
Are we there?
Are you guys there?
Yeah,
we're still here.
I'm here.
Did I get cut off?
No, you're good.
Okay. One of the other things I wanted to bring up, though, with that, whether we're talking about new hybrid construction or adaptive use construction, another pet peeve of mine that I've posted on and that I try to cover when I'm teaching is the reliance and the
Can you guys hear me?
The push to, yeah, I can hear you, Chris. I'm going to keep going, though, if you guys can hear me, is that it's the reliance on performance versus prescriptive fire codes. One of the things that gets me is that a lot of municipalities are allowing performance fire codes to run rampant on whether it's adaptive construction, remodels, renovations, or new construction. I think it's a big problem, and one of the finest examples of performance codes gone wrong is Edgewater, New Jersey. In that, hey, it's a sprinkler building, so we can leave 6-inch or 8-inch mains out in the street, even though we have a 1-square-block, 5-story or 4-story wood frame, lightweight constructed building. Hey, it's sprinklers, so we don't need to improve the water main size. Oh, we don't need to put that firehouse down the street because it's a sprinkler building or this or that. So you're allowed to cut things out. Because we expect it under certain conditions or under what we wrote down on paper, we expect this building to perform this way. So we can cut all this other stuff out. We don't need to have 10 exits. We can go down to 5, or we can do this, or we can do that. Well, that's all well and good on paper. The problem is fires don't behave the way we write them down on paper, and those lead to even more problems down the line. If you guys agree with that or have a different take on that, let me know.
You're spot on, Mike. We talk about the evolution of the codes, and we talk about performance-based standards and regulatory requirements that have contingencies on the performance or the functionality of other required systems or activities. And I talk about activities meaning fire service availability on the municipal side, the operability of fixed or passive systems in a building. I mean, it's all of these integral activities that have to be functional and in place in order for everything to work. It's interesting because when we talk about the evolving nature of one of the new building types that's coming about as a result of mass timber construction and the movement toward the new type for construction out of the International Building Code, that is entirely reliant on a variety of different functionalities of passive and active building components and systems and inspections and testings and operability. So the question is going to be, what happens when something fails, wasn't built quite right, wasn't inspected in the frequency, there's an inoperability or some other type of an impairment of part or a full system? What happens when, you know, a series of dominoes start failing that creates a continuing implication on how that building is going to perform? So, you know, there's just a lot of things that are predicated that really create a lot of challenges here overall. We're just coming up here, I think, on our closing time frame. We've spent almost a good solid 90 minutes in our discussions, and again, we've talked about a variety of different things, and we can certainly be talking about much more if we were to expand this into another 60 or 45 minute duration. Let me ask you guys this, and again, I think we'll pick up upon this at some other point in time. I think the conversation is worthy as it relates back to our listeners. Hopefully the listeners are gaining some insights with however little or wherever they may be in terms of their career and experience levels, but there's a lot of takeaways here in our discussions and certainly the information that each one of you has presented. I'll start with Doug, and I'm just going to ask you guys, what's your takeaway for our listeners? What's a couple of sound bites here that's your major takeaway based upon what we've sort of communicated through our thread here tonight? And Doug, I'll start off with you.
Well, I think that the takeaway that people need to be, closing out our show with is, bottom line is, what we know may not be all we need to know. I think we need to be diving deeper into our knowledge about buildings, about construction. I think we need to be diversifying that type of knowledge, not only, like you said, from a fire service side, but from an architectural side, a design side, performance of how it's going to respond and looking at history. We know that we have many, many, documents that tell us what has happened in buildings and how we can actually go about predicting even futuristic events that could occur right in our districts. I think that we have to become more engaged in our knowledge about buildings and about the fire that we're actually attacking in that building and breaking it down into the terms. That's your battleground. And like we said before, going into an unknown battleground is almost like a suicide mission. You need to know that intimately. So how do you get that knowledge? One, you've got to get formalized education. Two, you've got to get out into your districts. Three, you've got to study that and actually look at the things that are going on and understanding what's there. You know, the insights about the code trade-offs is so critical. Most folks don't realize what is cut out of buildings, what's allowed to occur based on these code trade-offs. So I think the education about our buildings and about our knowledge of building construction needs to be enhanced significantly.
Very good. Rick, your closing comments and perspectives.
Well, I'll fall back to my mantra is that you got to get out there and know your local. There was an example that just popped into my head. A few years ago, I was watching our local newscast here in a town to the west of us at a serious fire in a restaurant, and they had a May Day situation, almost lost two firefighters. The chief is being interviewed by the local reporter, and he's telling the reporter how, well, the building had a sub-basement that we didn't know about. And I'm sitting there to myself, this restaurant's been in their local for more than 50 years. But the local fire department wasn't aware that it had a sub-basement. I'm sorry, that doesn't cut it with me. We spend a lot of time on a lot of other things in the fire service, but we don't spend enough time on what our actual battleground is, and that's the building, getting out there and see how they're configured.
Sound words, to say the least. Mike Richardson, your takeaways, closing comments.
Sure. Thanks, Chris. I would say you have to make informed decisions. We cannot be successful on the fire ground if we're simply hitting autopilot and doing the same thing at every fire that we go to. So to make informed decisions, that's everything we've talked about, from adding knowledge through education, getting out, getting that firsthand experience, going through your district, and ultimately being able to take all that at 3 o'clock in the morning look at a situation and be able to make a good, solid, effective decision. And if we don't practice that or train that, we're not just going to magically get better at it. And most of us are going to a lot less fires than we used to. So we need to work on that through simulations. We need to work on that from learning from others, vicariously, secondhand experience. And once again, if we don't do that, there's severe consequences for everyone involved. So we have to work on that going forward. And Chris, one last thing. Per our earlier comment, my question to everyone would be, who's going to be the next Francis Brannigan? Who's going to be the next Dave Dotson? Who's going to be the next Vincent Dunn? Because we're none of us are getting any younger, and if this new generation doesn't get involved and buy into this, who's going to be that next presenter at FDIC that's talking about that topic? Because I'm looking at retiring 4 months from now, so who's going to replace me? We've got to start encouraging that group to step up.
Great words and great closing comments, Mike. Thank you very, very much. Mike Lapina, Chicagoland Insights, what's your take and giveaway?
There's nothing more I think that could be said that's been already said. I mean, when you're following the group that we have, when you're playing cleanup hitter with the group we have, There's nothing left to say. We've hit it all. Everything that they've that Mike and Rick and Doug brought up are all it. You know that we have to spend that time. The other thing is that one of the things I notice when we talk about the company officers and everything else like that, when they're presented with things like building construction, because again, we've identified that it's something that is really not taught the way it should be. It's almost like an embarrassment or if I bury my head in the sand, nobody will notice me. And so, taboo subject. They don't have the information to talk about it. So, well, it's just better to ignore it because I don't, but they don't want to admit they don't know anything about it. And to that, I would say, don't be ashamed. We've identified that it is a serious lack in the official training requirements through NFPA and the various state fire academies and everything. Don't be ashamed of the fact that you're not that up on it, because the fact of the matter is you were not taught it. So, put your ego away, and that's for everybody. Candidate firefighter all the way up to chief officers. Put your egos away. Find the people that know what they're talking about with building construction. Sit in a class, and you will be amazed at the information you pick up. And you will no longer have that embarrassment and that ego getting in your way.
Great words, great words. I'll say this, and I got a couple of closing comments. If you're going to command or tactically engage in a structural fire, you better understand the building, the fire, and understand your companies. Again, there's limited margin for error on today's evolving fire ground. And as we've constantly talked in all of our programs, errors and omissions are very, very unforgiving on today's fire ground. One particular quote, and I'm just going to read this verbatim here, and it ties right into what we've talked about. If you don't fully understand how a building truly performs or reacts under fire conditions and the variables that can influence its stability and degradation, the movement of fire and the products of combustion, and the resource requirements for fire suppression, in terms of staffing, apparatus, and required fire flows, then you will be functioning and operating in a reactionary manner. This places higher risk to your personnel and lessens the likelihood for effective, efficient, and safe operations. You're just not doing your job effectively, and you're at risk. These risks can equate into insurmountable operational challenges and could lead to adverse incident outcomes. Someone could get hurt. It's that simple. It's that obvious. Fire Chief Anthony Aiellos, the chief of the Hackensack, New Jersey Fire Department, wrote these words on one of the anniversaries of the Hackensack Ford Fire of July 1988. He was the fire chief on his watch in which he lost five of his firefighters, and those words resonate with much of what we've been talking about and discussing and having a conversation about tonight. And we have just really just, again, as we always do, are just scratching the surface, you know, Whenever we've gotten into any of our multi-series programs and podcastings and conversations, you can, number one, tell the passion of all of our guests, and certainly that is right in line with both Mike's and with Rick and with Doug here tonight. I want to thank all four of you, number one, for taking time out of your busy schedules to, number one, share that with our audience. And then secondly, and more importantly, I want to thank all four of you for your continuing dedication in these affected areas that we've been talking about here, the built environment, firefighting command, decision-making, and all of these elements here that ultimately lead to a more efficient and a safer fire service for all of us. So I want to thank you for listening in. And that really is it for our program here tonight. Until next time, companies are in quarters and off the air. Stay safe, but keep in mind there's a job being worked somewhere in the streets, in your city, across the country and around the world, doing what we do best and being who we are, firefighters. So take care, everyone. We'll see you next year on the 2022 editions of Buildings on Fire, Taking to the Streets, here hosted on fireengineering.com, Blog Talk Radio. We'll see you at FDIC in April of 2022. And I look forward to some other new initiatives and programs that we have coming up here in the first part of the year. So my guests, again, thank you very much. For our listeners, for those of you who are listening in live, again, you missed the opportunity. You should have called in. And for those of you that are listening in a recorded session, please take advantage of our live programs. We try to really make these programs accessible to you, our listeners, and that opportunity to call in and ask those questions. So until next time, stay safe. We'll see you on the street somewhere, again, on your street, in your city, across the country, and around the world. Thanks, everybody. Take care, and happy holidays.
You too, Chris. Merry Christmas to everybody.
Merry Christmas. Happy holidays to everybody out there. Thank you, guys.
Likewise. Same to everyone.
Thanks, everybody. Take care, brothers.